www.sfm.co.nz.
Senior Focus.
Welcome everyone. I'm Anne-Marie Curry. I'm your presenter for this session of Senior Focus. And it's been an exciting development to have the interview with John Elliott last time and to know that he's coming forward with us, and we're going to be having more discussions about population growth in Auckland and heritage issues and issues about the democratic voice around the council decision making. So there are very interesting developments happening with our program. Keep listening. Today's session I've entitled Facing Our Future, largely because these days on the news it's getting more and more scary as we listen to threats about the Delta virus, what's happening in New South Wales and Fiji with the rising death tolls and the cases in the community leading to greater transmission. And widespread resistance in the population to perhaps taking up vaccines or not wearing masks or not social distancing and so on. And I'm not talking about our country particularly, but, you know, to see just how blasé people are about the developments, and with the new variants coming through, they're so much more virulent and so much more of a threat that it doesn't seem sensible for humans to be so blasé, but indeed they are. And no matter what pronouncements are made by government leaders, there doesn't seem much change in people's behaviour. On the same level, though, we have this recent new report coming through on climate change warning that no matter which way you spin the data modelling on emissions, no matter what scenarios you stack up, it doesn't seem likely that global warming will be slowed below 1.5 degrees, which would stem the tide of global warming. So it's not going to happen, it looks like. And that means the future weather will be more extreme in the next decade. Flooding, fires, heat waves, and as we already are seeing in Greece and California and so on, these are not just simple fires. These are fires that create huge maelstroms into the atmosphere. They have such heat that they control weather at a much higher level, and they're very, very difficult to deal with in any constructive way. The catastrophic consequences for people are just they're hardly able to be contemplated, and certainly nobody would wish this on their worst enemy. So it's no wonder that we have a lot of youth who express mistrust and distrust in governments, that they express lack of hope and despair, and it's really understandable. People would want to turn their focus to living for today and bugger tomorrow. The frustration with the lack of protection for our trees has been bubbling away within not only Auckland but in many towns and cities throughout our country. So there's frustration about what isn't happening, and there is frustration with what is happening, like developers ripping trees down and all in the name of progress. But that seems very short term and very dangerous given the situation of global warming. So with the lack of substantial action by government, despite making predictions and announcements about the emergency, the climate emergency, and we have to respond to it, and, you know, these pronouncements are being made, but the types of actions, the types of planning, the types of strategies that are being debated and discussed around the policy tables just don't seem to be seriously cutting the mustard in a practical way. This lack of global leadership also is not just our country, it's right across the planet. And the tree cover, the loss of tree cover in the Amazon basin, for example, something that, you know, was struck home to Sir Peter Blake on his expeditions. And, you know, he woke up fast and he was very determined to take maximum action as much as was possible in terms of raising the awareness across the globe. And people continue to do this, but it seems to be a very fraught task, and there's loss of life associated with this taking of action in this way. So I'm not able to solve all this in a session. I'm not able to point to any dramatic possibilities except to say that individuals can take action. I mean, there are things that you can do individually, and you might think, oh, well, it's not really making a difference. But the thing is that if everyone begins to take action, then it's like a stone gathering moss. You get a much greater collective effect. And I think that that becomes something that even the politicians will have to take notice of. Certainly, just despairing and sitting in a heap isn't going to improve matters. There are a number of strategies and campaigns around to go plastic free, to reduce your waste, and so on, and to use bees wraps, for example, instead of plastic wraps, to do reusable coffee cups when you go out rather than takeaway cups. You know, there's all sorts of things that you can say no to, and you can start to get change occurring. And I think that, you know, even if you made a step in that direction yourself, that would be a signal to all the people around you, and so you can actually influence others in that sort of process. I know there are groups meeting, hosting workshops to transform old clothes into shopping bags and upcycling clothes. And I mean, really, when you look into the rag trade, there's such a lot of waste ends up in the landfill, and that's contributing to global warming. And so it's not just the chopping down of trees, but it's also the actual amount that's going to the tip. And we can actually do something about that. I know in the days of old, people used to have rubbish fires. I remember having an old burn-up in the backyard was quite common, with old oil drums, and people used to put all their waste in that and burn it away. I don't think people are doing that now, but more drastic change is going to come. I mean, more fires are going to be outlawed in certain towns and cities, because the particulate matter coming out of these fires is contributing to global warming, and so the emissions levels that you know, people are trying to bring down, they're trying to attack by these various means. And so people will grumble and complain because they don't want to change what they're doing, or they don't want to spend extra money. But there will be a cost, and there will be more than just changing the habit. There will be an actual financial cost. And so whether it's upgrading to an electric car or upgrading your wood burner or whatever, these are things that people are going to have to grapple with and allow for. So not good news, but it might be better news than all the consequences that we collectively are likely to be facing in the next decade. So do consider before you rush out and spend money and buy more of this and more of that and consume more of this and that, do think, now, how can I shift the emissions that are going on? What's the impact of this purchase? What am I investing in here? What am I supporting? What does this company do for the environment? What is the consequences of my purchase? And I think the more you take stock of that, the more you realise, well, I don't need this takeaway cup, or I don't need to rush out and buy new clothes. I could actually renovate what I've got. I could also invest in some better quality things that last rather than just cheap throwaway stuff. So, I mean, I know myself, I've always believed it's worth it to spend getting something of reliable, good quality, particularly if it's leather shoes or a natural product, an organic cotton or silk, something that will last that I can wash by hand and delight and take care of and use over a long period of time. And going for classic cuts and clothes and that allows you to have a lot more use out of the item over a long period. So there's some of the best op shops in Auckland frequented by members of high society, and it's quite trendy to say I got this in an op shop. I don't think there's anything bad about recycling clothing or op shopping per se. Apart from spending less on your clothing, you just have more variety and you can actually reduce the amount that's going to landfill. So there's heaps of things that you can do, although some of them have strange twists. I mean, there is the problem of the batteries with the electric cars. Where are the batteries going to be disposed of? How? And, you know, that's not a short-term issue, but long-term it's quite a big issue. So we don't have the answers to some of these things yet. I do hope that New Zealand can position itself to be a leader in green technology, to be an innovator, and to actually come up with more innovative solutions to all the vagaries and problems and issues surrounding climate change and global warming, because we have a lot going for us as a country and we could be doing a lot more than we are. So this could be something that is generated as part of our Kiwi spirit, and we could all participate in this. But certainly we don't want to be ostriches with our heads in the sand, and we don't want to be climate change deniers or thinking we can turn the clock back to what New Zealand used to be like. I know there are some people who would like to do that. And so this program, when we examine climate change, when we examine population growth, when we examine intensification in Auckland and the ramifications of some of the really big changes that government's bringing in around the Resource Management Act, around the urban planning rules, and also about investment in infrastructure and the three waters. And these are really big discussions, and they have very important issues for democratic voice, and people need to understand more to get on board with the issues. It's not all plain sailing, and it's not all without some intense battles and conflicts, I think, in some areas. But there are opportunities, there are new processes and new ways of doing things which can alleviate some of the worst disasters and consequences that are coming. And we need to be open to this. We need to be ready to embrace the possibilities that change presents and not defensive. So this will be part of our attitude abroad when we're putting these programs together. We're not there with all the answers. We're not there preaching with people that you must do this or must do that. And we're not there to say there's a magic answer to this, you know, vote for so-and-so, or this party's got the answer, or these people are the people you should be listening to. No, because really, the world has never been here before. We've never actually been in this kind of predicament. And we've never ever before had to contemplate what level of cooperation we're going to have to exhibit, even with our enemies, even with the people that we would normally not side with. You know, there's going to have to be a rethink on a very big scale and strategy devised on a level that we haven't really tackled before. And this is going to require people to move away from fear-based thinking and from old die-hard attitudes. It's going to ask people to recognise that if you want a future for your grandchildren, then you can't keep doing what you've always done. There is no merit in that, or common sense. So my message is to join us on the journey, come and listen in to the programs, and you can, of course, be able to tune in online. You can go to the library and get help from a librarian to listen to the program through headphones at the library. At home, you can go to Planet's website, www.planetaudio.org.nz, and you can look up programs, you can look up Senior Focus, and you can find our most recent programs there, and also some archived podcasts. So there's no reason to not take advantage of all of this, because there are a lot of people who are thinkers, who've got fresh ideas, and who are very keen to become part of the journey with Senior Focus on Planet. So do tune in on a regular basis, because you're going to be up to date, and you're going to become more aware of the things that you can do and that other seniors are doing at this time. And it's good to be able to talk about things that might be rather disturbing, that might give us nightmares or might worry us. I think it's very important that we can actually air these kind of concerns and not feel that we need to somehow pretend it's not happening, or that it's all going to go away, or that someone's overstating it. It's hard to seem that it's real sometimes, I guess, because in New Zealand we still have a very beautiful country. We can still drive into the country, and we can still enjoy much of what is a beautiful place. But I think most of us have actually noticed changes around us. Most of us are aware of more than just plastic and rubbish at the beach. There have been just so many instances where the weather has been so extreme that people have had to evacuate their homes. And I think more people have had to evacuate in the last 3 years in New Zealand than in the previous decade. So, yes, we've had events in the past, but they haven't been so extreme, and we haven't had them so close together. And sometimes we're only just getting over one disaster and we've got another one on our doorstep. Also, some of the intense weather has dislodged and uncovered some of the mistakes of our past, where large amounts of waste were tipped in not very good places, adjacent to riverbanks, for example. And when the weather disturbed these places, the consequences were very extreme. I'm thinking of the Fox River on the west coast and what a huge clean-up was required there. But we have many rubbish dumps that have asbestos in. We have many dumps that are leaching rather nasty toxic messes into our waterways. And we've got some within the council territory in Auckland, in the Auckland region, and they are going to cost large amounts of money to fix, into the millions. Firstly, the amount of stuff that was dumped and the variety of it and the toxicity of it at the time and in the future now, as it's broken down more, it's become even worse, the impact of all these different toxins together. And in such odd places, places where it will require a road to be built into them before they can be decontaminated and the toxic stuff removed. In some cases, a barge will have to be brought in from the harbour. But that won't do it all. A road will have to be built as well, which will cost $1 million on its own. Because of the steepness of the terrain and so on, the engineering involved is going to be quite considerable. And these are kind of costly mistakes where stuff was dumped and a blind eye was turned in the past. But global warming is going to expose this kind of mistake, and it will be costly and it will be difficult for those in power to deal with it in a way which is transparent and at the same time maintains their own capacity to keep their roles, because people are going to be very angry, and where are they going to turn that anger and how are they going to manage the consequences? It's all going to be very demanding. Life isn't going to get easier, that's for sure. Now, one of the things that, of course, can become a white elephant in this situation, and we can have even more costly mistakes made, is heritage. We can actually have people seeking to get rid of heritage buildings in order to make a quick buck, in order to sell the airspace above land, in order to maximise what can be built on a certain piece of land to get a greater return. And this continual drive for profit and greed can destroy a lot of places of great significance and beauty, and places that just have a lot to do with our collective consciousness and our memory. That's what makes our country our country, is those heritage buildings and those places that have our history. We're a young country, so when we lose a lot of heritage in one swoop during a particular time of economic thrust and development, it can be a sort of a tide that takes a whole lot with it. And when the tide has gone out, that's when we can live to rue the day and think what might have been. I'm thinking of Lambton Quay in Wellington, which in the early 70s was quite a magnificent piece of a ribbon of urban prestige in terms of the wonderful heritage buildings that were there. And there's really only about three or four such buildings left in the whole of Lambton Quay. One or two facades have been kept and the buildings behind reshaped. But it's really quite sad to see how much was completely obliterated in the 70s and 80s. And in Christchurch we've lost a lot because of the earthquakes, and some we lost unnecessarily, could have been saved if there had been a different process employed because those working on the sites post earthquake, those companies that had the contracts, they were actually being paid by the ton of what they took to the tip. They had no conscience about what they were throwing out, and they had no incentive to retain or recycle or negotiate with anybody to save anything. And, of course, because a lot of the red zone was policed by gun, at gunpoint, there was magnificent stuff in there that just went. And this is part of the tragedy of the Christchurch earthquakes. Now, in Auckland, we see periodically intensification occurring, and but now we're facing greater intensification with the Central Rail Loop project coming to fruition. The value of land close to the Central Rail Loop is going up, and it's the airspace above the land that's most valuable. So villas, double-storey buildings, even three-storey heritage buildings are going to be very much at risk. And the new assessment the council is putting together is going to challenge a lot of people's thinking. It's going to be very tricky. So this will be something we need to air more on the program. We need to go into this in more depth. And I look forward to interviews around heritage. We've got Heritage Week coming up in September, so it's a really good time to focus people's awareness around these issues. And for your listening pleasure, we have Joan Armour Trading's new album, Consequences, with a track, Better Life, just as to end on a positive note. So enjoy, and we'll be together again for the next session next week. Thank you for listening. All you want for everyone is a better life.